Welcome to the North Carolina Reading Service. Today is April 15. Your readers are Joe McPheeters and Kent Miner. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and it's readily available as a podcast after the broadcast by going to our website, ncreadingservice.org. This broadcast is generously supported by The Forest at Duke. They can be reached at 800-474-0258. We thank them for their contribution. We'll be reading from USA Today, starting with news, followed by money, sports, and life sections. At 8:30, our feature program will be drug and department store ads.
The TV listings tonight on ABC at 8 o'clock, American Idol, 7-1-1, top 14 reveal. The top 20 take the stage as Ryan Seacrest reveals the 10 hopeful America has voted to advance. At 10 o'clock, interrogation tapes, The Devil in Disguise. Detectives open interrogation room to a surprising guest as they try to get to the truth. On CBS at 8 o'clock, The Neighborhood. Welcome to the Standoff. At 8:30, Bob Hart's Abasola. Diamonds are made to sparkle. 9 o'clock, NCIS, 1,000 yards. Vance tries to mend fences with his son by explaining why he still chooses to stay at NCIS. 10 o'clock, NCIS Hawaii, the next 1,000. On Fox at 8 o'clock, MasterChef, Mystery Box. At 9 o'clock, So You Think You Can Dance, Challenge Number 1, Music Videos. The dancers split into two groups and take on music video challenges. At 10 o'clock, Deal or No Deal Island. Are you meticulous? On NBC at 8 o'clock, The Voice. The Knockouts Part 2. Keith Urban serves as mega mentor to all of the coaches. To all of the coaches' teams as the knockouts continue. On ION at 8 o'clock, FBI. What lies beneath? OA must protect a controversial leader from Egypt. Another episode of the FBI at 9 o'clock, Appearances. An FBI agent is found to have been leading a double life. At 10 o'clock, another episode of FBI, Closure. The team uncovers an unimaginably large criminal operation. On PBS at 8 o'clock, Antiques Roadshow, North Carolina Museum of Art, Hour 2, Miss America pageant trophies from 1921 and 1923. At 9 o'clock, Antiques Roadshow, Santa Clara Hour 2, A Lambert Magician Automaton, Ray Bradbury Archive. At 10 o'clock, Big Sonia, made in 2016, Sonia Warshawski. Sonia Warshawski is confronted with a tough decision. On MNT at 8 o'clock, Dateline, Buried Secrets. At 9 o'clock, Law and Order Special Victims Unit, Locum. Another episode of Law and Order Special Victims Unit at 10, Shattered. On CW at 8 o'clock, All American, Business is Business. At 9 o'clock, Sight Unseen, Sunny. And at 10 o'clock and 10:30, there are programs from National Station, and these are live, whatever they are. Okay? And then on A&E at 8 o'clock, The First 48, Bloodline. At 9 o'clock, The First 48, Dangerous Company. And a third episode of The First 48 at 10, Standing Ground. On AMC at 8 o'clock, a three-star movie, Pretty in Pink, made in 1986 with John Cryer, Andrew McCarthy, and Molly Ringwald. And at 9:45, another three-star movie, Ghostbusters, made in 1984 with Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis and Bill Murray. On BET at 8 o'clock, a one-star movie, Tyler Perry's Boo 2, A Madea Halloween, made in 2017, starring Tyler Perry. And at 10:30, it is Martin. On the Disney Channel at 8 o'clock, Haley's on It, another episode of Haley's on It at 8:30. At 9 o'clock, Marvel's Moon Girl. 9:30, Ladybug Evolution. At 10 o'clock, Miraculous Ladybug. At 10:30, Ladybug Destruction. On the Discovery Channel at 8 o'clock, Contraband, Seized at the Border, The Beatles Live. Another episode of Contraband, Seized at 9 o'clock, Lime and Punishment. And a third episode of Contraband, Seized at the Border, The Hitman. That's at 10 o'clock. On ESPN, starting at 7:30, is the 2024 WNBA Draft, and that will be live. And at 9:30, it's the NHL Hockey. It's NHL Hockey with Minnesota Wild and Los Angeles Kings. On Nickelodeon at 8 o'clock, at 8 o'clock and 8:30 are episodes of SpongeBob SquarePants. At 9 o'clock and 9:30, episodes of Young Sheldon. And at 10 and 10:30, episodes of Friends. On TNT at 8 o'clock, the three-star movie Thor Ragnarok, made in 2017 with Tom Hiddleston, Kate Blanchett, and Chris Hemsworth. And at 10:45, it's Kids TV. Finally, on USA at 8 o'clock is WWE Monday Night Raw. The superstars of the WWE square off in the ring and behind the scenes.
You are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, connecting people who are blind and print impaired to each other, their families, and communities by delivering news, information, and entertainment using the latest audio technology. In addition to using specially tuned subchannel radio receivers, NCRS streams its programming on our website, ncreadingservice.org. You can listen by using the Listen Live streaming audio player located at the upper right-hand corner of our website pages. If you have an assistive technology device such as Alexa or Google Home, just say, "Tune in NC Reading Service" to listen instantly. We also provide podcasts of over 50 magazines and other information and entertainment programs following their initial broadcast. Again, please go to our website, ncreadingservice.org, and click on the Listen tab, and then click on Skip to Podcast section. For more information about the North Carolina Reading Service, please call us at 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Accessible Pharmacy Blindness and Mental Health Summit. Accessible Pharmacy, a provider of home-delivered prescription medicines with talking bottles, is hosting the first annual Blindness and Mental Health Summit. This virtual and free summit is the largest online gathering of organizations and consumers sharing information, resources, and services focusing on mental health in the blindness, low vision, and disability communities. The Blindness and Mental Health Summit will be held online Friday, June 14, from noon until 4 p.m. For more information or to register for this free online event, visit the Accessible Pharmacy website at accessiblepharmacy.com. You will find the Blindness and Mental Health Summit under the Events tab. Arts Access Gallery is excited to host its second exhibition titled A Celebration of the ADA, featuring works of art created by North Carolina artists with disabilities. As they celebrate their 40th anniversary and the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, commemorates its 34th year, they want to know what you celebrate in life. The exhibition will be on view at Arts Access Gallery in downtown Raleigh, June 7 through July 26. The gallery is located at 444 South Blunt Street, Suite 115B as in Baker, Raleigh, North Carolina, 27601. This exhibition is open to North Carolina artists who identify as having a disability and are at least 18 years of age. Works from both established and emerging artists are welcomed. The submission deadline is April 22, which is a week from today. For more information on the exhibition and to apply, please visit the Arts Access website. The full call for art can be found on the Arts Access Gallery page. There's a very long URL here, and what I would suggest is just Google Arts Access. North Carolina Assistive Technology Program, NCATP, Pop-Up Fair. Get active and get outdoors. The North Carolina Assistive Technology Program has been hosting pop-up fairs at various locations throughout the state. Learn about local resources and get hands-on experience with accessible equipment, regardless of your ability, and an adaptive recreation and active living resource fair. Fairs are free and open to the public. We encourage everyone interested in staying active, accessible recreation, and leisure activities to attend. A pop-up fair will be held at the following location and date. May 3rd, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Charlotte AT Center in Charlotte. The event is free, but registration is required. To register or to learn more about the NCATP Center nearest you, visit their website at ncdhhs.gov/NCATP. Tactile tours available at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Designed for visitors who are blind or have low vision, these docent-led tours explore the museum's collection through audio description, tactile experiences, and by engaging the senses. Tours are by request only and must be scheduled at least 2 weeks in advance. To schedule a tactile tour, please call 919-664-6854 or email Accessibility Coordinator Molly Hull at mhull@ncartmuseum.org. Turning to the front page of USA Today, headlines across the top. After worst Masters finish, Tiger Woods looks ahead. He says it was a good fight and plans to play remaining majors this season. Star-studded lineup toasts Jimmy Buffett at concert. Paul McCartney, Sheryl Crow, and Snoop Dogg among those honoring late legend. Travelers play role in restoring coral reefs. In the Maldives, resorts take steps to protect fragile ecosystems and encourage guests to get involved by planting coral. More headlines. New York court delves into new territory. Jury selection and hush money trial of Trump Monday. Israel vows Iran will pay for weekend attack. Biden, G7 leaders to coordinate a united diplomatic response. Fighting climate change by cloning trees. And our final headline and first article. Experts weigh in on how likely it is Trump does time by Aisha Bagchi. If former President Donald Trump is convicted on all counts in his New York criminal hush money trial that begins Monday, he could theoretically face more than a decade in prison. But most legal experts who spoke to USA Today said such a dramatic outcome is unlikely. Instead, he would be likely sentenced to something between probation and 4 years in prison. And he would probably still be out, free to campaign for president as a presumptive or actual 2024 Republican nominee, while his all but certain appeal was pending. Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to adult film actress Stormy Daniels. Each count carries a maximum sentence of 4 years. While Trump could in principle be sentenced to serve multiple counts consecutively, several experts said that is unlikely because he has no felony criminal record and the charges don't involve allegations of physical violence. On the other hand, Trump has tested boundaries and feuded with a judge who may determine his fate. Trump's sentence would be decided by Judge Juan Merchan, who has grown exasperated by the former president's pretrial behavior. Merchan expanded a gag order this month after Trump attacked the judge's daughter on social media over her marketing work with Democratic candidates, including posting a photo of her. Merchan said Trump has a history of attacking the family members of judges and lawyers in his legal cases. The average observer must now, after hearing defendants' recent attacks, draw the conclusion that if they become involved in these proceedings, even tangentially, they should worry not only for themselves, but for their loved ones as well, Merchan wrote in his gag order decision. John Moskow, a New York lawyer who spent 30 years in the Manhattan District Attorney's office, told USA Today that type of behavior could worsen any sentence Trump faces. If I were representing somebody in Trump's position, I would suggest to him that the judge is the one who imposes sentence and he ought to be careful, Moskow said. If Merchan did consider a hefty sentence, it wouldn't be the first time he has taken a harsh view about behavior in Trump's orbit. In 2023, Merchan was forced to sentence former Trump Organization Chief Financial Officer Alan Weisselberg to only 5 months in jail because Merchan had previously accepted a plea bargain agreement between Weisselberg and prosecutors specifying that jail term. Weisselberg pleaded guilty to tax and record falsification charges and agreed to testify against the Trump Organization at trial in order to get that sentence. The judge said, however, that he would be imposing a sentence much greater than that had he not accepted the plea bargain before hearing all the evidence at trial. Without the plea deal, Weisselberg could have faced many years in prison. Trump has pleaded not guilty to all counts in the case, which focuses on whether he falsified business records to cover up reimbursements to his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, for a $130,000 hush money payment to Daniels. Daniels has said she had a sexual encounter with Trump soon after Melania Trump gave birth to their son, Barron Trump. Trump denies the claim. In order to secure felony convictions, Manhattan's District Attorney Alvin Bragg's office must convince a 12-person jury that Trump falsified the records in order to commit or conceal another crime. In this case, Bragg argues Trump was trying to conceal a federal campaign finance law violation by falsely recording his reimbursements to Cohen as payments for legal services. The federal violation was a limit-exceeding contribution to Trump's 2016 presidential campaign, as the payment was allegedly designed to keep Daniel's story from hurting the then-Republican nominee's election prospects. Bragg also alleges Trump was trying to conceal a plan to violate New York tax and election laws. Nothing in the Constitution prevents Trump from becoming president, even if he is convicted or sentenced to prison. If he won the election, however, courts may delay any prison time until after his term in office expires. The 34 felony counts Trump faces are classified as Class E felonies under New York law, the lowest level felony in the state. The maximum penalty on each count is 4 years of prison, and a judge would have discretion over whether to order Trump to serve sentences on each count at the same time or one after the other. However, New York caps such sentencing for Class E felonies at 20 years. In addition, New York judges often impose sentencing ranges where an incarcerated person becomes eligible for parole at the low end of the range. For Class E felonies, the lowest end of a range would be 1 1/3 years per count, while the highest would be 4 years. Good behavior in jail or prison can speed things up even more. Merchant also would have discretion to order a fixed sentence of less than those ranges, including probation. That's what Mitchell Epter, a New York lawyer with decades of criminal law experience, expects would happen even if Trump were convicted on all counts. Epter noted the felony charges aren't violent and don't involve drugs. With a defendant who has no prior criminal record, my absolute expectation would be a sentence of probation, Epter told USA Today. Epner wasn't alone in thinking that could be the sentencing outcome. This is a case that does not involve any physical violence, and it doesn't. There's not a sort of a named victim, so to speak, and so the court is going to take that into consideration, Anna Kaminsky, who directs a criminal defense clinic at the New York Law School, told USA Today. In addition, I think it is unlikely that he would be sent to prison given who he is, given both the fact that he has no criminal record and that there is no getting around the fact that he's a former president of the United States, Kaminsky said. Norman Eisen, a Brookings Institution senior fellow who served as special counsel to the House Judiciary Committee during Trump's first impeachment, thought a sentence that includes some incarceration is likely. Eisen co-authored a report looking at sentencing for other defendants with no criminal history who were convicted of falsifying business records in New York. There, he noted one construction executive was sentenced in 2015 to spend 2 days each week in jail for a year for falsifying records to conceal payments in a bribery scheme. In 2013, two corporate executives were ordered to spend 4 to 6 months in jail for falsifying records to misclassify their salaries as expenses under their employer's larger bribery and fraud scheme. I think he's likely to face a sentence of incarceration if he's convicted, Eisen told USA Today. Kaminsky said the evidence Merchant hears at trial could also influence his thinking when it comes to sentencing. Often you'll hear judges refer to testimony at trial, evidence that was presented at trial, and say, that is why I'm imposing this sentence, because I heard this from a particular witness or I saw this particular piece of evidence, Kaminsky said. Moscow pushed back against the assumption that Trump's sentences on each count would run simultaneously instead of being stacked on top of each other. Just as a judge may take into account that a defendant has won a Nobel Peace Prize or lifted orphans from poverty, the judge may look at significant evidence of bad acts, Moscow said. When you start attacking the judge's daughter and making her out to be a target, you have just breached the normal rules, Moscow said. Trump has also posted a photo of himself wielding a bat, with his eyes directed toward an adjacent photo of Bragg, among other attacks on the district attorney. Bragg's office has received thousands of harassing emails, calls, and texts, including death threats, after Trump's social media attacks, it said in a court filing. Diana Florence, a New York lawyer who spent decades in the Manhattan District Attorney's office, said Merchant's sentence would need to have some relation to what other white-collar defendants in similar cases have received. And she would be surprised if someone had ever gotten a sentencing range for falsifying business records with a minimum of 10 years or more. Such a long sentence would be very, 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 very unusual, and if Judge Merchant wanted to make a point and do that, I highly doubt the appellate division would allow that to stand, she said. It's just too much time for the conduct. However, Florence added that a reasonable sentencing range could include a minimum period of more than a year incarcerated. Contemplating any jail or prison sentence would take Merchant into uncharted territory. Trump is the first former president ever criminally charged, and the Secret Service provides him with round-the-clock security. But avoiding a sentence of incarceration on that basis risks undermining the idea of equal treatment under the law, Moscow suggested. If I were the judge, and I don't know what a judge would do in this case, I would reject out of hand the concept that because he was once president, and because as a matter of policy the Secret Service guards former presidents, that therefore he can't go to jail, Moscow said. The question would then become how to reconcile equal treatment with ensuring a former president's security, according to Moscow. The judge could get creative, for example, by ordering the president to stay in a hotel wing or at a military base, where he is isolated just like any other prisoner, but still has Secret Service protection. You can structure things to achieve the proper result without conceding that the defendant has the upper hand, Moscow said. Many convicted defendants are remanded pending sentence, a process in which they are taken into custody while they await their sentence, Florence said. But Florence didn't expect Merchant to give that order when it comes to Trump, and even if Merchant did, Trump would likely be able to get bail set by an appeals court in the thousands of dollars to stay free during his appeal. That's all the more likely if Trump receives a low sentence, since the appeal could take longer than his actual sentence, he said. She said. The chances of him going to prison immediately, even if he's convicted in whatever, 6 weeks from now or whenever, are, I would say, less than 1%, because he would immediately be released on bail pending appeal, according to Florence. Eisen agreed Trump probably wouldn't be incarcerated by Election Day, even if he's convicted on all counts. I think he's extremely unlikely to be forced to serve that sentence pending appeal, Eisen said.
Okay, continuing with Mr. Trump, this headline is, New York Court Delves into New Territory by Aisha Bagchi. Barring a last-minute turn of events, a former American president will go on criminal trial for the first time in the nation's history on Monday. Donald Trump is fighting 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to porn star Stormy Daniels in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election. If convicted, the charges could land the presumptive Republican presidential nominee in prison. Many legal experts say a realistic sentence ranges from just probation to as much as 4 years behind bars. It's a case that is sure to divide the country. Republican voters delivered electoral victories for Trump in nearly every Republican primary held this year, despite knowing Trump faces four criminal cases, including the New York charges. Trump has portrayed both Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg and trial judge Juan Merchan as biased against him. There are some people who are just going to see this as a political trial, another one in New York, where Trump is certainly not well-liked, Hank Scheinkopf, a New York City-based political consultant who worked for former President Bill Clinton, told USA Today. And then there are others who will see this as a way to deal with an illegality that should not have occurred. We're talking about paying off a porno star, Scheinkopf said. Jury selection is set to start Monday, just over a year after Bragg announced the indictment against Trump on April 4, 2023. The trial is expected to last between 6 and 8 weeks, according to a media advisory from the court. 12 jurors will be asked to decide whether the real estate mogul falsified business records at the Trump Organization in order to conceal or commit another crime, a purpose that turns the acts into felonies under New York law. Prosecutors allege Trump reimbursed his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, for the $130,000 hush money payment through a series of checks, falsely labeling them as payments for legal services. That concealed a federal elections law violation because the $130,000 payment was meant to help Trump's 2016 election and exceeds campaign contribution limits, according to the prosecution. They also say the records were meant to conceal plans to violate state tax and election laws. Trump has pleaded not guilty to the charges and recently submitted a frenzy of legal filings trying to delay the trial, so far to no avail. Both sides have framed the case as being about election interference, but they are talking about different elections. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg has said the case is about falsifying records in order to unlawfully interfere with the 2016 election. The core of "It's Not Money for Sex," Bragg said in a December WNYC radio interview. "We would say it's about conspiring to corrupt a presidential election and then lying in New York business records to cover it up." Cohen paid Daniels less than 2 weeks before the November 8th election day, and at the time when Trump campaign was still reeling from the October 7 release of the infamous Access Hollywood tape, in which Trump crudely described kissing women and grabbing their genitals. "When you're a star, they let you do it," he said. Trump feared another scandal that could hurt his standing with female voters, according to prosecutors. Ultimately, with pressure mounting and the election approaching, the defendant agreed to pay off, they said in a case document. Trump has said the case, and all his criminal and civil cases, are intended to harm his prospects in the 2024 election. They represent an illegal attack on a political opponent and election interference at its best, he posted on his Truth social media platform Wednesday. Norman Eisen, a Brookings Institution senior fellow who served as special counsel to the House Judiciary Committee during Trump's first impeachment, agreed with Bragg's election interference framing of the case. "The reason that Donald Trump made hush money payments and then covered them up, triggering the financial falsification charges in New York, over 30 of them, is because he did not want another damaging sex scandal at the end of the 2016 election, right after Access Hollywood, and it could have tanked him," Eisen told USA Today. The trial will start with jury selection, a days or weeks long process in which both sides will try to suss out potential personal agendas towards Trump. After jury selection, the two sides are expected to make opening arguments. The prosecution will then call witnesses and introduce evidence, while Trump's team tries to poke holes in the prosecution's case. After that, Trump's side will have the option of putting on their own defense, including having Trump testify. On Friday, Trump said at a Palm Beach news conference that he plans to testify in the New York trial. "I'm testifying. I tell the truth. I mean, all I can do is tell the truth. And the truth is that there's no case. They have no case," Trump said. Trump also said he was going to testify when it was the defense's turn to call witnesses in his New York civil fraud case, but he backed out the day before his lawyers said he would take the stand. Trump did testify for just a few minutes in his latest of two trials against E. Jean Carroll, who sued him for defamation over his denials and attacks soon after she came forward with rape allegations against him. Theoretically, the trial could be halted somewhere along the way. For example, a lawyer or witness could say something in front of jurors that the judge rules is improper and creates too much prejudice against one side or the other, forcing the judge to declare a mistrial. If that doesn't happen, the two sides will give closing arguments, and then Trump's fate will be in the hands of the jury. The trial will not be televised in keeping with general New York court policy. Reporters will be present in the courtroom, as well as in at least one overflow room in which proceedings will be streamed. Trump may hold news conferences outside the courthouse or speak to the news media in the hallway, as he has in his other court cases. Testimony could be embarrassing for the former president, even if Trump disputes it. Stormy Daniels is on the prosecution's witness list and may share her story of having sex with Trump in 2006, soon after Melania Trump gave birth to their son, Barron. The former president vehemently denies Daniels' claim. Judge Juan Merchan has also ruled that other witnesses who received hush money payments before the 2016 election may testify because steps taken to secure their stories complete the narrative in this prosecution's case. That includes former Playboy model Karen McDougal. Prosecutors say she received $150,000 from the National Enquirer's parent company, American Media Incorporated, to keep quiet about the alleged affair with Trump, which he denies. Michael Cohen could also take a turn on the stand. Trump's team bitterly fought the proposition that he could testify at all, calling Cohen an admitted liar. Cohen stated at Trump's New York civil fraud trial that he lied when he pleaded guilty to federal tax evasion. He engaged in tax omission, not tax evasion, he said. However, Merchan said Trump hadn't shown Cohen had lied in this case, and Merchan hadn't found any applicable law or court ruling that blocked a prosecution witness from testifying because the witness's credibility was previously called into question. Former White House spokesman Hope Hicks is also expected to testify, according to the NBC News and CNN, which cited a source familiar with the matter. Hicks was Trump's 2016 presidential campaign press secretary and may have been present for discussions about the Daniels hush money payment, according to court filings dealing with an FBI investigation. A lawyer for Hicks previously denied she participated in hush money payment conversations on October 8, 2016, a day when she and Cohen spoke several times. Ex-U.S. Justice Department official Matthew Colangelo is expected to be a key player for the prosecution team. When he was in New York Attorney General Letitia James's office, he worked on the civil fraud investigation that ended with a $454 million judgment against Trump. Trump is represented by Todd Blanche, who spent several years as a federal prosecutor in Manhattan, and Susan Nicholas, a former state prosecutor. She's very experienced. She knows how to try cases, Diana Florence, a former Manhattan prosecutor, said about Nicholas, whom she faced off against in multiple cases. Trump has certainly competent and able counsel, Florence added. Trump may keep antagonizing Merchan on social media as part of his apparent strategy to portray judges who he believes are unfriendly as biased. He has called Merchan a highly conflicted and corrupt judge whose hatred for me has no bounds. He has also targeted Merchan's daughter, calling her a rabid Trump hater based on her marketing work for Democratic candidates, and posted a photo of her to his to his millions of followers on Truth Social. Mershon expanded a gag order to prohibit Trump from attacking Mershon or Bragg's family. The average observer must now, after hearing defendants' recent attacks, draw the conclusion that if they become involved in these proceedings, even tangentially, they should worry not only for themselves, but for their loved ones as well, Mershon wrote in a decision. While some longtime New York lawyers told USA Today they believe Trump could well be sentenced to incarceration if he's convicted, others predicted a sentence of just probation. Trump would be a first-time nonviolent felony offender, but some defendants convicted on the same charges have gotten several months of incarceration in New York. Mershon may view the case's tie to alleged interference in the 2016 election as warranting a longer sentence than typical for falsifying business records, some experts say. If convicted, Trump would almost certainly appeal. Florence says he is very likely to remain free during his appeal. It is unclear what an incarceration would look like for a former president who has around-the-clock Secret Service protection. Would it be jail or prison? Would it be house arrest or some alternative placement? It's uncharted territory. Some commentators who are concerned about Trump's threats about are concerned that Trump threatens American democracy and national security have bemoaned the fact that his first criminal trial comes in this case. The ex-president also faces charges in Georgia and Washington, D.C., of trying to overturn his 2020 election loss, and in Florida of hoarding classified documents even after a subpoena, which many consider to be a more serious offense. Trump has pleaded not guilty in all cases. But some former prosecutors say the common perception that other cases are more significant doesn't mean Trump shouldn't be held to account in this case if he broke the law. The fact that it is not as bad as leading a revolt to destroy the American Republic leaves an awful lot of room, John Moskow, a New York lawyer who spent 30 years in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, told USA Today. Many Americans have said they believe the charges are significant. In an early April poll by Reuters Ipsos of more than 1,000 adults, 64% of registered voters said the charges are at least somewhat serious, compared to 34% who said they weren't. The remaining weren't sure or didn't answer. But Chinkoff says the trial could help Trump's 2024 campaign in certain ways. Those who love him will see this as just another way that the elites on both coasts, who they detest in the first place, which is why they love Trump, that the elites on both coasts are persecuting Donald Trump, he said. Chinkoff added that it will also be an opportunity for Trump to show his skills in turning the courthouse into a campaign trail. It will be a great show because everything Donald Trump does is a great show. He's the master of presentation, Chinkoff said. Stephen Hahn, a history professor at New York University, noted the trial is likely to bring out allegations of behavior by Trump that don't look very good to most people. He predicted a felony conviction will damage Trump politically. I just can't see how it could help him except solidify the support of people who are basically utterly committed to him, Hahn told USA Today. And then again, many believe Trump's presidential prospects were over after the October 2016 release of the Access Hollywood tape, Hahn acknowledged. He has amazing capacities. He's like a political Houdini, Hahn said.
Fighting Climate Change by Cloning Trees by Christopher Cann, Dateline Orlando. It's been struck by lightning at least three times and has survived multiple hurricanes, and it sprouted from an acorn around the same time Juan Ponce de León's ship first landed on Florida's eastern coast. Big Tree, an imposing southern live oak, sits in an unassuming park just outside Orlando's business district, its moss-covered limbs jutting out over 30 feet on all sides. Over 400 years old, the tree is so impressive that members of a Michigan-based nonprofit flew to Orlando in February to climb and sample it. The arborists are now in the midst of a months-long process to grow new roots from the clippings. The reason? To clone the historic tree, store its DNA, and plant potentially thousands of replicas across the southeast. The southern live oak, which has a trunk as thick as 8 feet, is part of a rare cohort of trees which have survived centuries of extreme weather, pests, disease, human interactions, and other life-threatening phenomena. Research has shown that such old large trees pull significant amounts of carbon dioxide out of the air and are integral to the diversity and resilience of forests across the globe. And with the increasing threat of climate change, arborists, researchers, conservationists, and others say that they must be protected and preserved, even perhaps through cloning. This tree is a survivor, said David Millarch, the co-founder of the family-run nonprofit Archangel Ancient Tree Archive, which is attempting to clone Big Tree. There's something in that DNA that, in spite of everything it's been through, it's still growing. It's still healthy. That's the type of tree we need. Native to much of the Southeast, live oaks are iconic figures in landscapes across the Sunshine State, from Tallahassee to the Florida Keys. They're among the state's largest native plants, able to grow 60 to 80 feet tall and 60 to 120 feet wide, according to the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. And though the massive oaks can survive centuries with their deep root systems and thick branches, which can withstand hurricane force winds, Big Tree is a Central Florida standout because it has outlived its contemporaries by over 100 years, said David Wagg, Orlando's Family Parks and Recreation Manager. We've got well over 100,000 trees that the city maintains, and we consider Big Tree to be the oldest, he said. It's obviously a grand old tree. The Parks Division first installed a placard noting the tree's historic status in the 1920s and, about 30 years later, bought the land, named the park after the live oak, and opened the park to the public. In the 1970s, the tree was struck by lightning at least three times during a ferocious thunderstorm. The city hired experts to inspect the tree and perform critical work on its root structure. Over the past 50 years, it has required minimal upkeep. When the city was connected with Archangel Ancient Tree Archive earlier this year, officials soon agreed to let the nonprofit's arborists ascend the tree's canopy and take samples. Over the past 30 years, Archangel Ancient Tree Archive has made its name on cloning more than 130 tree species across the country, including giant sequoias and 3,000-year-old California redwoods. The group's clones shade the streets of Seattle and Eugene, Oregon. In the Presidio, a park at the northern tip of the San Francisco Peninsula, 75 clones of near-extinct redwoods are growing. Its trees have also gone overseas, with a portion of the nonprofit's clone stock standing in at least seven countries around the world. The group has also cloned trees with notable historical connections. Horticulturalists replicated some of the last trees planted at the direction of George Washington on Mount Vernon, his estate in Virginia. They've also cultivated several clones of trees on Thomas Jefferson's Monticello estate in Virginia and Teddy Roosevelt's home on Long Island, New York. Millarch, the co-founder of the group, is a third-generation arborist. Growing up in northern Michigan, he spent countless hours working on his father's shade tree nursery, which he ran for several years and eventually inherited. But it wasn't until his 40s when a near-death experience led him to start the Archangel Ancient Tree Archive. In 1991, Millarch almost died of kidney and liver failure after he decided to quit drinking cold turkey, according to the biography The Man Who Planted Trees by Jim Robbins. About a month later, Millarch, who was still recovering, scrawled his plan to clone the planet's biggest and oldest plants. Ever since, he's dedicated his life to the project that he says may one day halt and reverse climate change. There was a clear line between my life before and my life after, the 74-year-old told USA Today, speaking of his epiphany. Until my last breath, I'll be working for the world's grandchildren. In order to clone an ancient tree, the Archangel Way, one must climb it. The group has made national headlines for this site alone, helmeted researchers hoisting themselves up the trunk of a colossal redwood or a sequoia in order to find, somewhere in the canopy, a piece of live tissue, tree cloning's vital ingredient, Millarch said. The freshly cut limbs and leaves are taken to the group's lab in Michigan, where propagators work to spur growth from the samples. The most common method is by rooted cuttings, which has long been used by horticulturalists. In this method, a tip of the tree's branch is dipped into hormones, placed into a foam plug, and set inside a mist chamber. Then the waiting begins. A sign of life could take months to a year, if one comes at all.
All right, now we'll go to the money section. Most Americans are claiming parents as dependents on taxes, by Medora Lee. Most parents claim their children as dependents on their taxes, but now an increasing number of Americans are claiming their parents, according to a recent survey. More than 54% of Americans ages 25 and older with a living parent said they're claiming their parents on their taxes this year. And 53% of them said they started doing so in the past 2 years, according to a Caring.com survey last month of more than 4,000 people. Poverty among older adults at least 65 years old has grown faster than any other age group in the past few years as inflation has risen, Census Bureau data shows. That has left many adult children supporting their parents and claiming them as dependents to save potentially thousands of dollars in taxes to help defray those costs. How much does caregiving cost? More than 48 million Americans are caregivers, providing a $470 billion in unpaid care for their loved ones. That's doing everything from helping prepare meals and pay bills to assisting with medication and medical nursing tasks to help parents, spouses, and other loved ones live independently in their homes. The average caregiver in the United States spent $7,242 in out-of-pocket costs in 2021, according to AARP. Many caregivers also are part of the so-called sandwich generation, simultaneously taking care of their parents and children. Of the 54% of Americans claiming their parents on their taxes this year, 74% have at least one child dependent, Caring.com said. As the baby boomer generation continues to age, we see how stretched thin the sandwich generation truly is, says John Farrell, Caring.com's Director of Financial Planning and Analysis. That's why we have seen a jump in Americans also claiming parents as dependents, the study said. How to claim a parent as a dependent? Check eligibility. Check everyone's status. You can't be claimed as a dependent on anyone's return. If your parent files a joint tax return, you may not be able to claim them as a dependent unless your parent is only filing a joint return to claim a refund for withholdings or estimated tax paid. Your parent must be a U.S. citizen, a U.S. national, a U.S. resident alien, or a resident of Canada or Mexico. Check your parents' gross income. Your parents' gross income can't exceed $4,700 for tax year 2023, $5,050 for tax year 2024. Calculate your support. Your financial support must exceed your parents' income by at least $1 during the tax year. To calculate your support, use the fair market value of your parents' room in your house, the cost of the food you provide, and the cost of utilities, medical bills, and general living expenses you provide. Does my parent have to live with me? No. In most cases, you only must provide more than 50% of your parents' financial support and meet the other status and income criteria. They can live at another house, nursing home, senior living facility, or sometimes even in another country. You can claim a parent if they are either a U.S. citizen, U.S. national, U.S. resident alien, or a resident of Canada or Mexico. What types of tax benefits can I receive? A handful of tax benefits you may be eligible for include child and dependent care credit if your parent lived with you for more than half a year and required a care provider while you worked. Some states also allow you to deduct a percentage of this credit from your state returns. Earned income tax credit if you have limited to moderate financial resources. Credit for other dependents. Deductions for medical or dental expenses you paid for your parent. As usual, you must keep detailed records of all your financial support for your taxes. Are there any drawbacks? Possibly. It's important to approach this decision with careful consideration, as it can greatly impact your tax situation, says Mark Jager, Vice President of Tax Operations at filing software company Tax Act. Your taxes will become more complicated. Adding a parent requires additional documentation for tax filing to support the claim, Jager said. Tax Act's recent report, The State of Taxpayer Stress in America, found that 58% of consumers already find tax filing to be a source of stress. As taxes become more complex for consumers, we may assume that will cause additional stress, he said. It also can affect your parents' eligibility for certain government benefits or assistance programs, he said. It won't affect your parents' eligibility for Social Security retirement or disability benefits, which are based on their own work history and not outside financial support. However, it may affect income-based programs such as food stamps and supplemental security income benefits, as the financial support you provide is considered unearned income and may exceed strict income limits. It's best to check with a tax professional or IRS rules and weigh what might get lost against the tax benefits. How many older adults struggle financially? Poverty among older adults rose to 14.1% in 2022 from 9.5% in 2020, the Census Bureau said. That's the biggest jump among all age groups, it said. This doesn't bode well for the 4.4 million Americans turning 65 every year through 2027, says Ramsey Alwyn, president of the National Council on Aging, a nonprofit advocate for seniors. 40% of those who claim parents as dependents are financially supporting their parents because their parents' savings, investments, and income, including Social Security payments, don't cover the current cost of living, Caring.com said.
Resort guests help keep the Maldives beautiful. Tropical destinations turning to coral restoration initiatives to sustain lifestyle by Kathleen Wong. The coral fragment from the seafloor off the coast of the resort Siam World Maldives in the Nunu Atoll had a stark contrast. 1 inch of the coral's light brown tips was bumpy with living polyps, while the rest was dull white, resembling a dead tree branch. This coral species, known as Acropora hemperchia, grows in the shallow reefs of the Maldives in tapered branches, which eventually look like a bush or dome as they grow. That piece of coral I spotted broke off from its home, likely due to a powerful wave or a careless snorkeler. Once it fell into the sand, it began to die off. To the untrained eye, it seemed like there was no hope for that little coral fragment. However, that fragment was far from dead, and the solution to reviving it was simple. Coral planting is a simple act of fastening a coral fragment to a metal frame and placing it in a safe, shallow area of the ocean. In mere months, the coral has the potential to flourish once again. As the corals regenerate, the reef becomes more habitable for fish that swim through and makes the frames part of their home. Over 25% of the world's fish inhabit and get their food from coral reefs. As climate change and human activity continue to threaten coral reefs, tropical destinations such as the Maldives are turning to coral restoration initiatives, such as coral planting, to save the ocean, which they heavily rely on for tourism and the local way of life. Resort guests are encouraged to get involved and protect the very ocean that drew them to the Maldives in the first place. And the call is being answered. According to Booking.com's Sustainable Travel Report 2023, two-thirds of its 33,000 survey respondents said they want to leave the places they visited better than when they arrived. 99% of people come to the Maldives for the ocean because they want to snorkel, said Mariam Thuhufa, a marine biologist at Siam World Maldives, which offers marine conservation activities for guests, including coral planting and lagoon cleanups. A lot of them do get very curious. A lot of them are keen to understand what they can see and how they can help. The Maldives is an archipelago of over 1,000 islands sitting mere feet above sea level, which means the country is 99% ocean. And that's where most of the natural diversity exists, from manta rays in the north to hammerhead sharks in the south. Without the ocean, the Maldives just can't exist, said Thuhufa. All Maldivians depend on the ocean in some way. 71% rely on it for their primary source of income. Maldivians get food from line fishing at coral reefs, such as snapper or emperor fish. Fishing for big game fish like tuna is also the second largest industry following tourism. Without healthy coral reefs, the islands wouldn't even exist. If you go to a local island, you'll see a lot of the houses are built very close to the ocean, right next to the beach, said Thuhufa. During monsoon season, from May to November, big swells wash away the beaches, but a healthy reef can break the wave energy before it reaches the island, she said. To Thuhufa, coral bleaching is one of the most pressing issues for the islands and something the whole world is experiencing. The last mass bleaching event, which occurred between 2014 and 2017, saw 15% of the world's reefs die off. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicts a fourth, even worse, mass bleaching this year. It's looking like the entirety of the Southern Hemisphere is probably going to bleach this year, said ecologist Derek Manzello, the coordinator of NOAA's, NOAA's, Coral Reef Watch, which serves as the global monitoring authority on coral bleaching risk. We are literally sitting on the cusp of the worst bleaching event in the history of the planet, he said. Up to 90% of the world's corals could be lost. Thuhufa recalled an uninhabited island she visited for volunteer research in high school. The reef was so beautiful, so many vibrant colors, she said. After the 2016 bleaching, she returned to the island to see how it was affected. It was the most devastating thing I've seen, she said. Everything was bleached. Everything was covered in algae. With tourism as the country's biggest industry, resorts play a vital role in the protection of coral reefs. Although construction and increased human activity can damage the fragile ecosystems of reefs, many resorts in the Maldives are working to protect their house reefs by hiring in-house marine biologists and creating nurseries for coral planting. New resorts in the Maldives need to undergo an impact assessment before they can break ground, or sand in their case. A 2018 study analyzing the direct impact of seven luxury Maldivian resorts on coral reef health found that the amount of live coral and the size of colonies increased over time if the resort had conservation initiatives in place. Your reef is protected in the sense that there's no fishing, and guests are told not to touch corals, Thuhufa said. A lot more is put into the reefs to keep them healthy. However, the study also revealed that resorts with poor management practices and more sedimentation and runoff can harm the reefs. I tried coral planting for the first time during my stay at SeaWorld Maldives, and it was surprisingly easy and engaging. Guests can book the experience via the resort app, which they download during check-in, or their resort ambassador can arrange it. Coral planting is an emerging type of coral restoration, and since it's only been done on a small scale, it doesn't tackle the root of the problem of coral bleaching or warming temperatures. It can, however, help make a specific reef a bit more habitable and spread awareness of the condition of coral reefs. The marine biology team met me on the beach with a hexagon-shaped metal frame and two containers filled with coral fragments they found. One by one, we attached the coral pieces to the frame using zip ties, ensuring they were flush with the metal. This way the coral will merge and regrow over the frame. We splashed water on the corals every half hour to ensure they didn't dry out. When the frame was finished, we placed it into a shallow snorkeling area to join over 100 other coral frames. The marine biology team checked on the frames and removed any algae so the coral could breathe. The frames come in shapes like hearts or rays, but remain open for fish to swim through. Although coral is sensitive, it's also a resilient animal. Yes, corals are technically considered tiny animals, since unlike plants, they don't make their own food. Sometimes as small as a pencil tip, polyps make up the coral structure we see and attach to rocks. Depending on the species of coral, and there are hundreds, the coral can take around 5 months to attach to the frame, and then a few more months to regrow, according to Thuhufa. As I dove underwater to explore the coral nursery, I noticed batfish, triggerfish, and other colorful reef fish seamlessly swimming between anemones and among the coral frames.
We'll do as much of this one as we can. Report sparks heated debate on Lunchables by Jonathan Limehouse. Lunchables are stackable as they are snackable, according to a website for the prepackaged meals, but a recent report is causing some parents to doubt whether their children should be eating them. Consumer Reports has called on the U.S. Department of Agriculture to remove Lunchables from the National School Lunch Program because of higher levels of sodium and high levels of lead in the food kits. Lunchables are not a healthy option for kids and shouldn't be allowed on the menu as part of the National School Lunch Program. Brian Ronholm, Director of Food Policy at Consumer Reports, which launched a petition to the USDA, said in the release, "The Lunchables and similar lunch kits we tested contain concerning levels of sodium and harmful chemicals that can lead to serious health problems over time." Here's what to know. Kraft Heinz calls study misleading. In a statement emailed to USA Today, Kraft Heinz, owner of Lunchables, said, "We are extremely disappointed with the reporting from Consumer Reports and believe the results of their study are misleading, causing undue concern over the safety of our products. The fact is that all Lunchable products meet strict safety standards set by government agencies," Kraft Heinz said. Consumer Reports admits that none of the food they tested exceeded any legal or regulatory limits, but they chose to bury that fact. In Consumer Reports reporting on metals, the results of the study are based on California's maximum allowable dose for heavy metals, the Chicago, Illinois headquartered food company said. All Kraft Heinz products, including Lunchables, tested well below the acceptable levels, according to the company. The metals they focus on are naturally occurring, and thus low levels may be present in any food product, Kraft Heinz says. We do not add these elements to our products. Are the Lunchables healthy? Maya Feller, a registered dietitian and nutritionist who worked with New York City Public Schools, says she's concerned about the regular inclusion of Lunchables and Lunchable-type kits because they're not nutrient-dense options for students, according to an interview with ABC News. "The high sodium content is definitely of concern, especially from a young age," Feller said. "The health risks associated with high and chronic consumption of added salts are well documented." From Feller's clinical experience, she would like to see more nutrient-dense, plant-forward options in schools, especially meals with less sugars, saturated fats, and added salts, ABC News reported. Though many may be skeptical of picking up a Lunchable, the FDA says it is not possible to completely prevent lead from entering the food supply. Although it's impossible to prevent lead in food, it's food manufacturers legal responsibility to significantly minimize or prevent chemical hazards when needed, according to the FDA. And now we'll go to the sports section. This is Nancy Armour's column, and the headline is "Pivot Point for the W." Not since it launched in 1997 has the WNBA faced a more critical season. Women's basketball has never been more popular thanks to the NCAA tournament that was so compelling and had so many big games featuring the biggest names that its final for the first time had higher ratings than the men's tournament, not by a small margin either. Caitlin Clark has become a cottage industry like Tiger, LeBron, and Tom Brady, gifting the league a gold mine with her star power, commercial appeal, and fan base. She's already got rivalries with Diana Taurasi and Phoenix Mercury and Sabrina Ionescu, Brianna Stewart, and the New York Liberty. And there'll be others once Angel Reese and Camila Cardoso are drafted Monday night. Sponsors are clamoring for a piece of the W, while ESPN and other media partners are tripping over themselves trying to capitalize on the blockbuster interest generated by the last two college seasons. Handle all this right, and the WNBA establishes itself as a true major league sport. Maybe not rivaling the NBA, but certainly leapfrogging the NHL. There's just one thing that could derail this freight train of momentum: the WNBA itself. Despite beginning its 28th season, the WNBA still often operates like a startup, or a league petrified its one step from folding. While the NWSL races ahead with expansion, It has added four soccer teams over the last three seasons and will add two more in the next 2 years. The WNBA plods along, having announced just one new franchise, which won't begin play until next year. It has tolerated horrendous placement for its playoff games, allowing ABC and ESPN to pit the WNBA finals against the NFL. No win battle, if there ever was one. It accepted second-class status from both the NBA, which still owns about half of the W, and some of its own owners, who all act as if they've done female athletes some grand favor by giving them a league, and that should be enough. As for marketing, making sure its stars were household names, the WNBA has been, quite frankly, abysmal. Though the WNBA, I don't think, has done a great job of marketing their individual stars for whatever reason, because there's been a lot of them, UConn coach Gino Auriemma said at the Final Four. Auriemma ought to know, given many of the players he's referring to played for him. Even WNBA Commissioner Kathy Engelbert acknowledges the league's poor history of selling its players. The WNBA had one marketing person when she took over in 2019, she said, and it has never had a CMO until she hired one in December 2020. Yes, you read that right. A professional league, one supposedly backed by the NBA, still has only one marketing person and no CMO after 20-plus years. NBA programs will devote entire semesters to this kind of business malpractice one day. Previous WNBA executives will no doubt cite money or lack thereof, and the folks who like to hate on women's sports will crow about the WNBA only surviving this long because of the NBA's cash. There's a difference between making money and being profitable, however, and the league is absolutely making money. Bloomberg projected the W would bring in between $180 million and $200 million last season, up from $102 million in 2019. That's not insignificant, especially given how woefully undervalued women's sports have been in terms of media rights and commercial dollars. Just for fun, go back and look at what the NBA revenues were in the 1970s, and the NBA didn't have to deal with systemic misogyny. But there is no excuse for the WNBA not to thrive now, not when players like Clark and Reese and in seasons to come, Paige Buckners and Juju Watkins are making big names for themselves in the college game and bringing all those eyes with them to the league, and not when the WNBA raised $75 million in capital 2 years ago, money Engelbert says the league has used to bolster its marketing efforts. That one marketing person is now 25. The WNBA did its first ad buys during the NCAA tournament, and the league and teams were promoting around Clark and other rookie stars even before the draft. One of those ads during the tournament, it featured Stewart eating Rookie-O cereal. We're just doing a lot of different things than we haven't done before, but it really comes down to marketing the stars, Engelbert told USA Today Sports. We're just blessed to have generational talent, and not just this class. Next year with Paige, 2 years after that with Juju, it's why we can be bold around expansion, bold around marketing dollars, bold around everything we're doing. This is the WNBA's magic bird moment, and it cannot afford to waste it, especially with a new media rights deal looming. The WNBA current deal is up at the end of 2025. Not only does the league need to be fairly valued after three decades of the opposite, it needs to have more say in when and where its games air. The WNBA is not filler programming, and the new deal needs to reflect that. But Engelbert won't have the leverage to demand what the WNBA deserves if the league allows Clark, Reese, Cardoso, and Cameron Brink to fade to the background, like Stewart, Iosku, Ahai Wilson, and so many others have when they got to the league. I tell my team every day, the bold will win, Engelbert says. This is not setting us up for the next 3 years to 5 years. It will hopefully set us up for decades. As if she needed any reminder of the stakes, Engelbert was at the Masters last week, and someone told her they'd seen eight people in Clark's jerseys walking around the Augusta National. While the Green Jackets were no doubt horrified at that breach of etiquette, it's a sign of how much the perception of women's sports has shifted in this country. I don't really get offended when people say, I never watched women's basketball before, Clark said after the NCAA title game. I think, one, you're a little too late to the party, and yes, but two, that's cool. We're changing the game. We're attracting more people. The WNBA has a golden opportunity right now. It better not blow it.
Bob Nightingale's column is headlined, Cardinals Trio Offer Hope as MLB's Black Ranks Sink. Dateline Phoenix. They are three baby-faced players, barely old enough to legally drink, still trying to prove themselves with St. Louis Cardinals, but at the same time, not only understand the enormous responsibility, but are embracing it. Right fielder Jordan Walker, shortstop Mason Winn, and center fielder Victor Scott II represent a generation of young black ball players who are trying to turn back the clock with the triumphant return of African-American athletes to Major League Baseball. The Cardinals are MLB's lone team to have three everyday black position players under the age of 25 this season, with Scott the oldest at 23. The last time a team had three black position players 23 or younger in their opening day lineup was the 2007 Tampa Bay Rays. We take a lot of pride, especially being in St. Louis with a large black population there, Wynn, 22, tells USA Today Sports. It's definitely cool. Having three black starters is pretty special for us and for the team as well. It's been a while. We want to go out there and show that baseball is also fun for the black community. Cardinals legends Ozzie Smith and Willie McGee sat down with the trio before the season, helping them understand the responsibility of bringing the next generation of black players to the game of baseball. This is the first time the Cardinals have an opening day lineup with three black position players since 2004, with outfielders Ray Lankford and Reggie Sanders and second baseman Tony Womack. It was great just talking about what we're playing for, Wynn said. Not just the names on our back, but also the generation that we're inspiring. I know Willie and Ozzie love it. It means so much to them to be able to represent the Cardinals the way those guys do. Major League Baseball, which is celebrating Jackie Robinson Day on Monday, commemorating the 77th anniversary of Jackson breaking the color barrier in 1947, desperately could use an infusion of young players to curb the erosion of African Americans in its leagues. The African American population on opening day rosters and injured lists this season is 5.7%, according to USA Today Sports Study, the lowest since 1955. Five teams don't have a black player on their roster, with 10 others just having one player. It means that half the teams in Major League Baseball have no more than one African American on its roster. Even more alarming, for the first time since 1952, there is not a single black Major League Baseball player on either the Chicago Cubs or Chicago White Sox, despite playing in a city with a metro population of 8.9 million and the largest black population in the country. That is crazy, just crazy, says Alec Thomas, the Arizona Diamondbacks' lone black player who grew up in Chicago and attended Mount Carmel High School. At my high school, everyone on the team but the catcher was black or Hispanic. It's just so weird. It's baseball. Players will tell you they grew up playing Little League on teams filled with black players, but by the time they reach high school and college, those teams turn white. The black population at the collegiate baseball level is only about 5%. Baseball cites the rocketing expense of travel, baseball, and showcase events, costing families nearly $20,000 a year. They talk about the fact that there are just 11.7 scholarships for NCAA Division I teams. And of course, there's the fact that with so few black players at the major league level, kids are simply turning to sports where players look like them. MLB, which has had three black players called up to the big leagues since opening day, is encouraged. There are 23 other black players on 40-man rosters who are in the minors. They've had 74 African Americans participate in their spring breakout games, including 30 who are alumni of their MLB development programs, like the Hank Aaron International Dream Series, the MLB Tour, and the Breakthrough Series. Still, with fewer black kids playing high school and collegiate baseball, the Cardinals trio are determined to make a difference, helping reverse the ugly trend. I think myself, Maine, and Jordan can be extremely important for the youth of the game, said Scott, who graduated from West Virginia University and stole 94 bases in his second professional season last year. At the end of the day, it's about who you are impacting. So my goal is to impact as many young African-American players as possible, kind of visualizing themselves, being in the major leagues or in college baseball or in the minor leagues. All that stuff is important.
OJ's Legacy Strikes at the Heart of Race by Jarrett Bell, and this is his column for today. It's complicated still. O.J. Simpson is dead. Maybe his body and soul will rest in peace. His tattered legacy certainly won't. Simpson, who succumbed to prostate cancer on Wednesday night in Las Vegas at 76, goes down in history as the ultimate American tragedy in so many ways, from football legend and Hollywood star to accused double murderer and the Hall of Shame. What a complex journey. Simpson was acquitted by a Los Angeles jury for the brutal slayings in 1994 of ex-wife Nicole Brown Simpson and her friend Ron Goldman. Yet the presumptions, buttressed by a liability judged in a subsequent civil trial, are going with him to the grave. If you were among the 95 million people watching in real time on national TV as a Ford Bronco transporting Simpson, driven by his friend and former teammate Al Collings, rolled down the L.A. freeway in the low-speed police chase in June 1994, it was a series of images you'll never forget, and no, it was hardly a move consistent with innocence. This while people chanted from freeway bridges, "Go, O.J., go." Remember Simpson as polarizing, whether he intended to be or not. It's fair. The so-called trial of the century and its aftermath struck at the heart of racial inequities in America and criminal justice system that historically has victimized people of color. That's part of his legacy, too. 3 years after the acquittal of four white police officers captured on video brutally beating a black man, Rodney King, which ignited the L.A. riots in 1992, an all-black jury found Simpson not guilty. When the verdict was announced, the basic reaction from many white Americans was visible disgust. Simpson's blood was part of the evidence. He didn't have an alibi. He had a history of domestic violence incidents during his marriage. Even so, when the verdict came, there was no shortage of images of cheering black Americans. It was deeper than the testimony and cross-examinations of a racist, white Los Angeles police detective whose background included using racial slurs, and planting evidence, which undoubtedly weighed on the jury. It was deeper than defense attorney Johnny Cochran's classic plea, "If it doesn't fit, you must acquit," as Simpson couldn't squeeze his hand into a glove found at the murder scene. The reaction from black people had more to do with the entrenched pattern of social injustice in America over so many years that railroaded and sometimes lynched black men who faced bogus charges. Simpson, it seemed, was a benefactor of some sort of criminal justice payback. That, too, is part of his legacy. And how ironic is that? This was the same Simpson who never involved himself with civil rights issues as he became a household name during the late 1960s, unlike other high-profile athletes of that era. Instead, during his heyday, Simpson told people, "I'm not black, I'm O.J." That stance, during previous chapters of his life, didn't pose a threat to his legacy. Back then, Simpson was widely revered as a hero. One of the all-time great running backs, he led Southern Cal to a national championship and was awarded the Heisman Trophy in 1968. Drafted into the NFL by the Buffalo Bills as the number one pick in 1969, the Juice powered the electric company and in 1973 became the league's first 2,000-yard rusher. Kids like me adored him as he raced through defenses in a spot built cleats en route to his 1985 induction in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Off the field, he won the crossover appeal. Simpson was the first black athlete to explode as a commercial star, running through airports as a Hertz spokesman. It continued after football. He landed roles in more than 20 movies and had TV gigs as an analyst for ABC's Monday Night Football and on NBC. Simpson seemingly had the world in the palm of his hand, but that was back then. Did he do it? That question formed the essence of Simpson's legacy for nearly 30 years, and many will tell you that it's not even a legitimate question. As news of his death spread, it sparked, as you'd expect, a fresh round of re-litigation and passion, only this time with the added layer of social media. Simpson's complicated legacy, though, is a reminder of cracks in American society on so many levels.
Turning to the life section, Music's A-List raises a toast to Jimmy Buffett by Brian Alexander, Dateline Los Angeles. In a night filled with wildly eclectic musicians honoring Jimmy Buffett at the Hollywood Bowl Thursday, Paul McCartney captured the range of the Margaritaville Bard's impossibly wide web of global friendships and joy of living. Entering the stage late in the Keep the Party Going tribute concert, McCartney, 81, spoke about being invited to Buffett's home a week before the party-loving singer-songwriter died of skin cancer in September at age 76. "He was in a pretty bad way, but he still had a twinkle in his eye," said McCartney, who sat behind the piano to perform the song he had played for his dying friend, the classic ballad Let It Be. In Thursday's performance, McCartney jammed along with the Eagles and Don Henley. For the next and final song, McCartney joined music stars as diverse as Sheryl Crow and Pitbull for Buffett's signature Margaritaville, with Sir Paul proudly hoisting a Las Vegas-sized margarita on stage. "This is a man with a margarita right here," said McAnally, the longtime guitarist from Buffett's Coral Reefer Band, who served as musical captain for the evening. Here's who else kept the buffet party going. Buffett party going into the star-studded concert attended by fans including Al Pacino, Courtney Cox, Larry David, and Sean Penn. Honorary Coral Reefer band members Crow, Carlisle rocked. Crow said she was an absolute nobody when Buffett hired her in 1989 to join his Coral Reefer band. "I know Jimmy is laughing his ass off," the singer said before breaking into Finns. "I need to see some fins," Crow said, instructing the crowd to put up their land shark fins during the song. There were fins on stage, fins to the left, and fins to the right. Carlisle spoke of bonding with Buffett over their mutual love of fishing. "That was our language," before belting soulful versions of two classics, Tin Cup Chalice and Come Monday. Snoop Dogg blows smoke at My Main Man Jimmy B. Stage presenter Judd Apatow thought it might have been the suspicious smoking going on backstage that was making him hallucinate what he had seen on stage. "I swear to God, I just saw Snoop Dogg sing Gin and Juice with the Coral Reefer Band," Apatow said. It's true. The rapper and Buffett friend Snoop Dogg performed the classic song from his 1993 Doggy Style album in tribute to My Main Man Jimmy B, singing the familiar words with the audience in between onstage puffs. "Last time I saw you, we smoked like there was no tomorrow," Snoop Dogg said from the stage, before clearing out, leaving a cloud of smoke. During the wide-ranging musical section that followed, ukulele virtuoso Jake Shimabukuro wowed with a solo version of While My Guitar Gently Weeps, and rapper Pitbull performed his classic Don't Stop the Party with four backup dancers. "He's the definition of what it means to unite, not divide," Pitbull said of his friend before belting the song he wrote, "Thank God and Jimmy Buffett, along with John Bon Jovi." "He gave me fashion advice and hair tips," Bon Jovi said. "We all think we're rock stars, but he flew his own plane to his own show. That's a rock star." Friends who were not able to make it to the concert paid tribute over video, including Dolly Parton, Alan Jackson, James Taylor, and surfer Kelly Slater. NBA coaching legend Pat Riley laughingly recalled when Buffett was ejected from a Miami Heat game for calling a referee a parrot head. Many friends spoke in person from the stage, including tennis legend John McEnroe, who talked about Buffett watching him play during his hot-headed prime. "He told me, 'Relax, man,'" McEnroe said. "Of course, he was right." Harrison Ford spoke about long, boozy lunch with Buffett and 60 Minutes newsman Ed Bradley. I saw both of them had earrings, so right after lunch I got my ear pierced, Ford said. That's how infectious Jimmy's coolness was. Enough for a then 40-year-old man to get his ear pierced spontaneously and infectious enough to create this world around his music. There's no other way to say it. There will never be another Jimmy. Of course, the tribute ended with Margaritaville. Naturally, the night's final song brought the entire cast on stage to sing Buffett's national anthem of Margaritaville. Jimmy Buffett would get a big kick out of this deal, McAnally said, as the sprawling crew of musicians, friends, and Hollywood stars took spots at various microphones. It was like a superstar karaoke, with Crow, Bon Jovi, and Henley sharing the microphone for one of the signature Wasted Away Again and Margarita verses, Phil verses. By the end of the song, McCartney's margarita was nearly drained. But he was in no hurry to put down the glass as he walked off stage with a smile.
This is a television preview. Sympathizer muddles its big ideas by Kelly Lawler. A TV show shouldn't have to try so hard to be great. HBO's The Sympathizer has all the appearances of prestigious Emmy Award-worthy series. Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning 2015 novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen, it has weighty subject matter, the Vietnam War and espionage. The star power of Robert Downey Jr. and beloved South Korean auteur Park Chan-wook as one of its masterminds. It's produced by Buzzy Studio A24. Yet in spite of this talent and raw potential, Sympathizer, Sundays 9 Eastern Daylight Pacific Daylight Time and streaming on Max, is 1.5 stars, is the dictionary definition of underwhelming. Overly complicated, overly stylized, and often boring. Park and co-creator Don McKellar can't coalesce the series' shifting timelines, desperate characters, cartoonish costuming, and moral ambiguity into a story that pulls you in. It's a whole lot of stuff shoved in your face with very little renaissance to show. The series' protagonist, the never-named Captain Hoa Ixanu, begins the story as a Viet Cong plant in the South Vietnamese secret police in the mid-1970s, just before the end of the war. To the Americans and the South Vietnamese, he is a loyal lieutenant to a foppish idiot general, Tong Li. But he's secretly passing intelligence to the communists on the other side of the border. When the general and the Americans flee the country as Saigon falls, the captain is ordered by the Viet Cong to continue feeding information to his superiors as a refugee in Los Angeles. There he goes on his own personal odyssey, often surrounded by white paternalistic figures who aim to use the captain in some way. All of them are played by Robert Downey Jr. in various states of prosthetic makeup, a CIA operative, a college professor, a film director, and a congressman. The captain also begins a steamy affair with Sophia Morey, Sandra Oh, an older Japanese-American woman who's as eager to rid herself of association with her Asian heritage as the captain is to cling to his. It's a lot of deep track. It is a lot to keep track of, and even harder when the series can't make you care about the captain or his scheming and spying. The stakes are muddled, and the characters feel like symbols more than people. The series deals in binaries, not quite as clever a device as the creators think it is. In addition to being a double agent, the captain is biracial, half French and half Vietnamese. One of his best friends is a devoted communist, and another is a soldier of the South. The captain is deeply dedicated to communism and his homeland, but is easily seduced by American popular culture. He refuses to live in the shades of gray and thus becomes an intentionally confused, ever-shifting figure. It has all the unfortunate side effect of distancing the protagonist from us. He is neither appealing enough to engender loyalty and investment, nor interesting enough to hold our gaze. Bigger problem, however, is the series' multiple timelines. There is a rough frame structure in which the captain relates the story of his time in America to his superiors, clearly under some kind of imprisonment and duress. And yes, humans don't always tell stories in the right order, but any insight gleaned from the constantly shifting timeline is sacrificed by the confusion it creates. And this sort of blatantly pretentious artistic choice tries to mask that story underneath is not particularly compelling. While I've not read the novel, it is easy to see how this kind of lackadaisical pace and intentional obfuscation of the timeline works on the page, where readers can take the text at their own speed and an omniscient narrator can be so much more effective. On screen, it's just a bit dull and dense. It's a shame because the sympathizer offers a perspective on American imperialism that is so often lost to our culture. Stories about Vietnam War are almost always told from the viewpoint of an American soldier, as all dear the Deer Hunter in Apocalypse Now. But we weren't the protagonists. The much-praised novel deconstructed Americans' perception of the conflict. But by the time you finish the series, you'll likely be nonplussed, which is one of the worst criticisms I can offer a piece of art. It's not good, it's not bad, it's just unaffecting. Considering the intense political and moral questions the series raises, it should create some kind of philosophical and emotional response in us, yet I cannot sympathize.
You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Joe McFeeters and Kent Miner have been reading from USA Today. This broadcast is generously supported by The Forest at Duke. They can be reached at 800-474-0258. We thank them for their contribution. The content of this program is intended for people